Hello and welcome to another edition of Critical Q&A, the show where I answer your questions based on what you've left for me in the comments section of my Q&A videos or have sent to me by email at askchrisshelton@gmail.com. If you haven't yet seen the Sensibly Speaking podcast for this week and you're at all interested in Scientology things, then I think you're going to want to check it out because I don't usually talk about Scientology stuff on the podcast, or at least I haven't a whole lot, but this week was different. I did an interview with somebody who had a fascinating interview, or sorry, theory about why L. Ron Hubbard acted the way that he did and why he thought the things that he thought. And it's pretty interesting and something nobody's ever floated before as an idea. So check it out. It is Sensibly Speaking podcast number 51, episode number 51, which just went up yesterday. So there you go. And also, if you have not yet seen the Deconstructing Scientology series that I've been doing, I think you'd also be pretty interested in that because I'm sort of taking apart some apologist academics and their sort of nonsensical views about Scientology. So that's been kind of a fun series, and that's going to carry on for quite a while because there's a lot of these academics who put some stuff out there, and I keep hoping that I'll run into an objective one. So maybe at some point in this book that I'm going through, I will run into that. So anyway, let's get on with your questions. We've got a lot of them this week. Ariana V. I noticed people talk about the Scientology community in Clearwater and Los Angeles. How is the community in New York City and Chicago? The reason I ask is because nobody ever mentions those two major cities in America. The org in New York City is huge, and the one in Chicago is like a hole in the wall that's falling apart. The reason that nobody really talks too much about any Scientology communities outside of Los Angeles or Clearwater is because they hardly exist in any area outside of those two cities. Those are major concentrations of Scientologists. There are probably in LA, there's probably a few thousand, and in Clearwater, there is probably a couple thousand, all throughout Florida and the surrounding neighborhoods and whatnot. There's a strong Scientologist presence in Clearwater, especially if you add in all the Sea Org members, because at the flag base there, there's easily 1,000 Sea Org members there. And same in Los Angeles. There's easily 1,500 Sea Org members there, likely, something like that. But when you go to city areas where there are churches of Scientology, like here in Denver, or in Albuquerque, New Mexico, or in Tampa, Florida. Well, not Tampa, Florida, because that's pretty close to Clearwater, but like New York City, Chicago, Detroit, St. Louis, Kansas City, any of these local places, the one in Hawaii, or the one in Moscow even. These are not major, major concentrations of Scientologists. The local churches is what I call them, or the class 5 orgs, as Scientology calls them, have communities of maybe 200 to 300 people. And hardly any of them actually go into their churches on a regular basis. They'd have to do some kind of call-in blitz to get them to all show up at one time to go to, say, a Scientology event or something like that. And that is the extent of it, because, as we know, Scientology has shrunk over the decades, and it's pathetically small now. And these local churches are trying to do these drives to build themselves up to be these ideal organizations that require, over 100 staff to man up these new church buildings that these guys are trying to purchase and renovate. And when they do, one for one, they have to import people from other areas, other geographical zones, because they don't have enough Scientologists in their local area to staff up their own organization. And this is supposed to be the big burgeoning, fastest growing religion on the planet, and it's like, no, it's not. And these little tiny communities, if you want to call them that, generally speaking, when it comes to active numbers of Scientologists, from my experience in the Western United States, there's a regular number of people who are doing services, doing courses, doing the auditing, you know, coming in and doing stuff, of about 100 people, you know, maybe max, on a weekly basis, like coming into these churches, and that's it. So, you know, you have these cities like Denver, it's got millions of people in it, 100 Scientologists actively doing Scientology. That's about it. That's the picture. So there you go. Blue Dance Lily. When in the Sea Org, do members continue to do auditing and courses? Or must one first get to OT8 before joining? If they continue with the auditing and coursework, how do they find the time when they are expected to work very long hours in their job position? A person can join the Sea organization at any point. They don't have to be OT8, and hardly any OT8s actually do join the Sea Org because they're so in debt that they're never going to get out of debt in order to join the Sea Org, because you can't go into the Sea Org if you have heavy personal debt or credit card debts or, you know, mortgages or a home or things like this that you have to make payments on. You can't be in the Sea Org because that kind of stuff, you're not going to make any money in the Sea Org. So how could you pay those bills? You can't. And so you have to deal with those things before you go in. So you see the catch-22 there. So there's no requirement on how much Scientology you've done before you can join the Sea organization particularly. They frown on and don't go after people who have no Scientology experience, because that just wouldn't make any sense. But there's no, you don't have to be OT8. Now, as far as the coursework and auditing goes, the policy in the Sea organization and also for staff members at the class 5 orgs at the local churches is they're supposed to be able to get 2.5 hours a day of study or auditing. That's what's supposed to happen. And if they do a full day of work, then that's, you know, and this has been translated to not 7 days a week, but 5 days a week. So this has been translated to 12.5 hours of what's called study time, whether you're doing that in the classroom or whether you're doing that in auditing. That's your study time. And Sea Org members are expected to do their 12.5 hours unless there's a special event, they're in ethics trouble, they are, you know, busted for some reason, which happens a lot. When there's special events, then they call what's called a condition one, where nobody goes on study and everybody's doing, you know, calling the Scientologist to get them to come to the events or doing some other thing like that. And because, as I've gone over in other Q&A episodes, there are so many events throughout the year, these condition ones happen all the time. Anytime there's some big, huge flap or emergency or situation that needs to be dealt with, and there's never enough time in the day to get all the work done that the few number of Sea Org members need to do, and it's all frantic, frantic, frantic. So study time gets pushed. It's always the first thing to go. It's always the first part of the schedule. Yep. No study, right? Individual Sea Org members also might have a hard time going to study, because when you go to study, whether it's in the classroom or whether it's in auditing, you are supposed to be well rested. And unfortunately, a lot of Sea Org members have a very hard time being well rested because they are kept up until all hours of the night doing whatever emergency handling they're supposed to be doing, or handling their ethics or discipline or whatever frantic nonsense is going on. And so they'll get, you know, 5-6 hours sleep a night. And that's fairly routine, right? There are times when things are a little chill. Everybody's getting sleep, you know. These things tend to go in fits and starts. I mean, in the 17 years that I was in the Sea Org, it wasn't like there was no time ever where I got 8 hours of sleep. The executives and the people in charge actually want people to get sleep and get fed and go to study and things like that, right? They're not all crazy. So they'd like things to go in a normal, you know, pace. But then orders come down from on high and it's, we got to get these quotas met. We have to make $1 million this week. Or, you know, we have to get 10,000 people to go to this event, and you've only got 3 weeks. And so everybody's on the phones, and this kind of thing is what happens. And when those orders come down or those quotas come down from command, well, there goes the study time again. And everybody just rolls their eyes and goes, damn it, you know, because Sea Org members want to go up the bridge. They want to do Scientology, but the lifestyle and the franticness prevents them from doing so. And so there's these fits and starts, and it goes in waves, and that's kind of the life of a Sea Org member trying to move up the bridge. Oh, and one last thing on this is, when you go into the Sea Org, the first thing you have to do is get educated and trained on being a Sea Org member. And that's not just that EPF, that Estates Project Force, which is the boot camp of the Sea Org. That's just the beginning of it. You do that, and then when you graduate that, you're now officially a Sea Org member, but you still have a whole bunch of courses to do in order to get indoctrinated on how to be a Sea Org member. And you have a whole series of things you have to do. And then, depending on the job you get, you have to get educated on that job. And there's usually a pack of issues this thick that you have to read and study and do a bunch of drills and various things in the classroom in order to know how to do your job. And so that's all required work before you're allowed to do any Scientology bridge, before you're able to do any of that bridge to total freedom stuff. So there's a very long runway just to get to doing regular Scientology courses and auditing that the public get. So that also gets in the way. And I've seen Sea Org members spend years, literally years, on those courses that I was just talking about before they can ever get to, you know, the good stuff. So there you go. Hamish Downey, I'm very curious as to your thoughts on companies and cult-like behavior. A few years ago, I worked for an organization which had some cult-like tendencies, and one of the biggest things that has helped me is actually watching ex-Scientology videos to help me understand my feelings about that company. Okay, I've never worked in the corporate sector where I can talk with personal experience about what happens there. And I'm not saying in this answer that all corporations do this or are like this by any stretch. But I do know from what I have seen and read and heard from other people that there are individuals in certain companies, right, either at the head of the company, who themselves believe that their company needs to be run kind of like a cult. Or there are people who come into these companies, Fortune 500 companies often, who sell the executives on some kind of training package or some kind of seminar work that they're going to do with their employees in order to make them more efficient, more loyal, better teammates, better team members, you know, that sort of thing. And they sell some package to the company executives that they'll come in and do this work with all their employees, and that work tends to be pushing cult-like methods on the company, right? And the way that you know that sort of thing is going on, because I'm not saying here that all team building exercises are, you know, going to end up in destructive cult behavior, or that it's a bad thing to try to get people more efficient. That's not my point. It's judging based on the result and on what methods are being used. And some of these companies fall for techniques that are cult-like techniques. In fact, one point I should make here also is groups like Scientology have a whole division that is trying overtly to infiltrate companies like Fortune 500 companies and get Scientology techniques into the company. So, I can't imagine that Scientology is the only destructive cult that's doing that. So if Scientology can come in and the Scientologists are dressed in business suits and have these very, you know, upscale looking promotional pieces that don't say Scientology anywhere on them, you know, they say they're called WISE, the World Institute of Scientology Enterprises, and they're management technology is called Hubbard Management Technology. It's not called Scientology. So somebody who doesn't know anything about L. Ron Hubbard could get the idea that this is, you know, that what's being given to them has nothing to do with Scientology, when in fact it's 100% pure Scientology. So that can happen. So now, in terms of the techniques that are used, what you're looking for, I made some notes on this, and basically when you create a culture within the corporation or the company where the company is the most important thing that's going on in the lives of all of the people who are in it, you should start looking out, because that's where your priorities are starting to get kind of whacked. When there's always going to be instances where somebody's going to have to put in some overtime or something like that. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about where, you know, the guy has a vacation with his wife planned, and then, you know, and it all looks good, and then suddenly, oh yeah, no, sorry, you know. And then if the wife gets a little upset about it, you know, the guy's boss is going, dude, you better get your wife straightened out, because, you know, this company is way more important than that, you know, than that situation, right, with your upset wife. When you start seeing that kind of environment being created, or that kind of attitude being pushed by the corporate execs or the corporate, you know, staff, then that's where things are going in a very, very culty direction. You know, also where company environment or the culture is like getting rid of any other distractions besides the company. And the first thing I think of here is Google. Now, I'm not saying Google is a destructive cult, but I did find it fascinating that they created an environment in the Google headquarters that you never had to leave. They had places you could go sleep, places you could eat, places you could go play some table tennis for take a break or something, right? But you never left the grounds. You are always working or living at Google. I thought that was the weirdest thing I'd ever heard of. And yet that's, you know, that's kind of this environment that's being created there, right? And I thought, whoa, that's not so good, right? And finally, if there are instances where the company starts testing their employees in terms of their allegiance to the company, right? They start putting conditions down or start putting, you know, job requirements down or something where you have to show that the company is, you know, is really like what's number one in your life, right? And your kid's soccer practice or your, you know, your wife's parents coming over or anything else outside of the company. Yeah, no. Mm-mm, right? So that, again, that's the sort of thing to look out for with that, where you might start seeing companies as cults. There you go. Junie Hiltunen. Chris, what is the educational level of Scientologists? Those who have trained in science and engineering seem to be absent from active or former members. Not to bash on anyone's education, you don't need a degree to be smart, and you can certainly be foolish even if you have one, but being educated in the scientific method seems to be a pretty efficient antidote to Hubbard's brand of BS. If only. This question actually highlights a commonly misunderstood theme that I get here on this channel and other places in the comments of a lot of my videos, which is that you have to understand that Scientology and other destructive cults and groups like them do not appeal to your reason or your logic or your intelligence. That is not what gets people into these groups. It is an appeal to emotion. It feels good. It feels right. They do things in their introductory actions or activities that are designed to get a person feeling a certain way, not thinking a certain way. It's not about, you know, laying out some logical platform on which this person is now going to join a cult. That's never how it goes, right? Anybody who can see the cult for what it is and see what's happening logically and intelligently doesn't become part of it, because they're being logic-based. It's when they can get you in and get you feeling like your life is ruined. There's something wrong with your life. There's something wrong with you. You need some help of some kind. And if you think about it for a second, who's got a perfect life? No one. So there's always some little hook that they can hook into and appeal to the person to get them to go, yeah, that's something I'd really like to change or improve or do something about with my life. I feel bad about that. It's not you know, what do you know is wrong with your life? It's what do you feel is wrong with your life? What do you feel bad about? What do you feel like, you know, you should change or improve? It's always feel, right? Okay, so a degree does nothing to combat that particularly in and of itself, right? In fact, you mentioned in your question that, you know, engineers aren't part of, you know, former members or active members. Actually, that's not true at all. And in fact, the number one group of people who were most interested in Dianetics when it first came out were engineers. They thought it was the greatest thing ever because it was so scientific. You know, yeah, it's pseudoscientific, but they thought it was scientific, right? It felt scientific. So that's how people get wrangled into this. So asking about the IQ or intelligence of Scientologists or anybody who gets involved in these groups is really a futile question, because that's not the thing, that's not the weakness that they're preying on. And so, anyway, that is commonly misunderstood out there, and I hope that helps clarify it. Jim Halpert. I know someone who joined Scientology as a joke, but actually wound up buying into this stuff legitimately. He's out now, but was in for 12 years. And ended up losing a lot of friends and a lot of money. My question is, how many people do you think join Scientology thinking they won't get in too deep, but actually do? Do they have different indoctrination techniques for different kinds of people? I don't think anybody knowingly joins a cult. They join a group that of people that, because there's some personal connection made, as I mentioned in my last answer, that appeals to them at an emotional level. And so all they really want to do at the beginning is hook you in to a thing that you want to change or improve, or something about the group appeals to the person at an emotional level that gets them to want to participate at a low level, right? At a beginning level, right? You don't, hardly anybody just dives in with both feet into the deep end. So when they hook you with that, right, you do, in Scientology specifically, I'll talk about here, you do an introductory service, you do a course, or you get some introductory counseling, which is designed to address and make you feel better about whatever it is that you think you need help or improvement with. Now, whether it really handles that thing or not is kind of beside the point. The whole point of that service is to make you feel better about it. And if they get that accomplished, then the next step that you have to acknowledge or you have to think is, oh, this worked. Somehow, some way, they have to get that thought to occur to you. This worked. Because then if that worked, now, whether it really did or not in the real world is beside the point. You just have to think it did. You're then willing to take the next step because you've now seeded that there's something here. There's something about it that is just great. You know, you'll tell your friends, you'll tell your family, yeah, I don't know. I heard all these bad things about Scientology, but you know, it really helped me with that, you know, with that little, that worry that I had about, you know, being fired at work, or it helped me with my Aunt Jemima, or it helped me with my, you know, talking to my wife, or whatever it is, that's the most important thing that Scientology has to do with you, is get you thinking, okay, I feel better, I'm now going to do the next step. And if it doesn't, you won't do the next step and you walk and you never hear, and that person never does Scientology again. And that happens to lots of people. We tend to concentrate here when we're talking about this stuff on the people who feel like it did work. But there are a lot of people that they don't get that result. And they pay $50, they do the class, and they go, yeah, whatever, and they walk out the door. So that does happen. But for the people that doesn't happen with, they do the next step and then they do the next one. And every single one of them has to work to some degree, but maybe a little bit less, and a little bit less, and a little bit less, as they do more and more services, because they're building up this faith in this thing working, and then they start selling them on the idea that what they really need is the stuff way up at the top. They need to go clear. They need to go OT. right? And they start selling this pie in the sky stuff that on day one, this guy never would have bought. He never would clear OT or whatever. I don't even know what you're saying. But because he's given into the idea that this stuff works, he will then, it's much easier to coax the person into believing that the really good stuff is up at the top, and he's going to have to work to attain that, and he's going to have to pay to attain that. But hey, it works, and all these other people who are here say it works, and so you get that group dynamic going on, and so he's hooked, right? And that's how it works. So there's different indoctrination techniques for different people, sure, but they all have to follow that basic guide, those basic guidelines I just sort of laid out to keep the guy going. And depending on the individual will depend on, you know, how much common sense he has, how much reason he has, how much the emotional appeal wears off will depend on how long he'll stick with that and keep going up to clear and going up to OT and paying out his money and doing his time until eventually everyone twigs on the fact, oh, this doesn't work, and they take off. You know, that's sort of the ultimate end result of Scientology, but it takes some people a long time to get there. So, there you go. It's time for Flash Answers. Cassie W. Do you yourself have any family inside the church who have had to disconnect from you? Nope. Don't have any family in the church anymore, and no disconnection has occurred with me. And I've actually done videos about that. I interviewed my mom where we talked about that at length as to how we prevented that from happening. So check it out. George Boslaw. Did you get a graduation ceremony when you entered the Sea Org or when you finished the 3-year slave rehabilitation camp, RPF? When you finish the Estates Project Force, which is the Sea Org's boot camp, there is a graduation ceremony. When you finish the RPF, there is no ceremony. There is simply... you get a piece of paper that from on high that your submission to graduate the program was approved, and you walk. You get the hell out of there that night, and you're gone, and you go get back onto your regular job with the rest of the Sea Org. Jane Doe, I'm really curious what a marriage ceremony would look like in Scientology. What kind of vows, traditions, etc. are used? And did Hubbard just make it all up, or is it based on some pre-existing customs? From what I recall, there are two marriage ceremonies in Scientology. L. Ron Hubbard wrote a whole series of ceremonies for things like funerals and naming babies and doing marriages and all that religious stuff. He did all that stuff in the mid-50s when Scientology was getting their tax exemption so that it would look like a legitimate religion. And some Scientologists use those ceremonies and some don't. It's not really something I need to go into a whole lot of detail about, so that's why I'm just answering it here as a quick flash answer. The two ceremonies I think that exist for marriages are a one-ring ceremony and a two-ring ceremony. So you have like the bride and the groom have a ring, and then the one-ring thing I think is where there's one ring and they trade it off or something like that. And Hubbard wrote the ceremonies for that. Okay, and so we've reached the end of another episode of Critical Q&A. I hope you found these answers educational, illuminating, enlightening, and kind of entertaining at the same time. Thank you very much for coming around, and if you think of it, or if you think that you'd like to support my channel, go ahead and do so. Show me some love either through PayPal or through joining my Patreon campaign, because this channel is entirely fan-funded by you folks, and I really, really, really thank you and appreciate that. So, see you guys next week.